Off in the salty ocean, off where the waves roll free, the sparkling water rises, then crashes to the sea. Out amongst the breakers, you'll have no need to fear. It's true, it's the blue frontier.
Welcome to a new episode of Rising Tide, the Ocean Podcast. This is David Helvarg, and my co-host is Vicki Nichols Goldstein.
How are you, everyone? I'm excited to be here.
And today, we're delighted to be speaking with Craig Foster, the Academy Award-winning filmmaker of My Octopus Teacher and co-founder of Sea Change Project, a South African-based nonprofit dedicated to the protection of one of the most amazing foundational species and habitats on Earth, the Great African Sea Forest. Along with his contributions to anthropology and zoology, tracking human history, naming new species and animal behaviors, he also has a new book out, Amphibious Soul, Finding Wild in the Tame World. I'm working on a book on the world's kelp forest myself, and Craig has actually spent over a decade doing daily plunges into the sea forest by his home. Let's start with when in your young life you first connected with the ocean.
Wonderful to be with both of you. Thank you. The day I was born, my parents brought me home from the nursing home, and we lived in a little bungalow. Half of the house was below the high water mark on the Atlantic Ocean. And my parents took me straight into the water. It was absolutely freezing. Of course, I screamed my head off. But actually, even before then, when I was in my mother's womb, she was diving almost every day. So it's, you know, literally from before day one, I've been part of this beautiful environment.
So your parents were lovers of the ocean and took you into it at birth and before. Who were they? What were they like in terms of connecting you to the ocean?
I mean, they absolutely loved the ocean. They bought this tiny little wooden bungalow, which was, as I say, you know, was so close to the ocean that at spring tides and during storms, if we didn't put these boards up all over the windows, the waves would lift rocks and just smash every single window in the bottom of the house. The isopods used to, you know, come through the house. It was literally like living in the intertidal zone. We were in the intertidal zone. That's what they chose. Most people thought, especially that time, which was mid-60s, that it was, you know, a very strange thing to do. But they absolutely loved the ocean. They dived every single week, every weekend, and just that's what we did. And because I was right there, and my dad taught me to dive by taking me on his back. So it was just part of our lives.
Now, in your book, Amphibious Soul, you talk about growing up with the ocean, but then you ended up spending a lot of time with people of the desert. How did that happen? And was that any form of rebellion or just a natural development?
More of a natural development, David. So, you know, my brother and I had grown up in this incredible ocean environment, and we were, you know, fascinated by nature. And in many ways, our greatest heroes were these almost mythological figures, the San master trackers. Some people, you know, would have known them as the Bushmen. So our natural thing was to try and seek them out and find the greatest trackers on Earth. We eventually managed to make our way up to the Central Kalahari, and we did our first film together, and we were very fortunate to be with these three incredible trackers. I mean, they were really at the highest level. They were the finest trackers in their language group, and they both inspired us very deeply and kind of terrified me, because I thought, you know, I'd grown up in the wild my whole life. I thought I was so close to nature, but when I was with them, I realized I had so far to go, so far. And I was actually outside of nature compared to them. And that was the motivation to do this daily immersion in the kelp forest and just to start to develop this idea of tracking underwater.
While you're still in Africa, I love your book and how you really told a couple of stories, and you had a particular tracker that you were really felt connected with. Can you tell us a story about one of your experiences?
One of the reasons we went up to the Central Kalahari was to try to capture something that had never been captured before, and that what was called the chasing hunt. And this is a ritualized hunt by these indigenous people that only happens maybe once every 3 to 5 years. And it's to test the real skill of the tracker at the highest level. And they put their bows and arrows down. It's in the middle of the summer. And they test themselves against an animal, a large animal, in this case, a kudu. And they try to run that animal down. And either they die or the animal dies or the animal escapes. So this had, you know, it was almost the stuff of legends. And we witnessed Karawa Langwani, who was one of these incredible trackers, running in this incredible heat. I think it was about 43, 44 degrees, which is well over 100 degrees Fahrenheit. And what was so fascinating, what you allude to, was that at some point, I think it was after about an hour or so, he stopped following the physical tracks of the animal. And he was just cutting across the tracks. And the central Kalahari, you can't see very far. There's just thick bush. You can only see maybe 50 or 100 meters. For 95% of this ritual hunt, the animal was not in sight at all. And for another maybe 70, 80%, there was no track in sight. So he went into a kind of altered state and was somehow able to know where that animal was. And the kudu are, you know, one of the most elusive animals. They're called the ghosts of the bush. So they're double backing. They're incredibly clever.
And this is a kind of antelope?
It's a very large antelope. Yeah, maybe the size of a big elk. So what he described afterwards was that he could actually feel the animal in his own body. Now, this doesn't sound like it would be possible, but then how is he able to continually find that animal in thick bush where it's almost impossible to see anything? And he was eventually able, after 4 hours, to run to a point where that animal, it's almost, they say, the hunter becomes the hunted. He becomes the animal. And it was just one clean spear to the heart, and he feels almost like he's taking his own life. He's completely merged with nature. This is a sort of high-level empathy and reciprocity through this high level of tracking. The animal is used to feed the entire village. Every single scrap and bone and piece of skin is used. Children are fed. And these people, you must remember, in a context, have been living in reciprocity for 80, 100,000 years with this environment, living unbelievably lightly on this land.
Let me move forward in time, which is, on any given day, there are close to 8 billion of our species on land, including the San, and only about 50 million people at sea, and that includes all the mariners and fishermen and military sailors, a handful of real sea people who are constantly in the water. How did you take tracking what you learned with the San and others into the water? What motivated you? What took those skills into the sea forest with you? What drove that?
What I realized, David, as I said, it was like this awful feeling of knowing, well, how am I going to even develop a fraction of this connection to nature that I'd learned from these incredible Mo and Gwikwe trackers from the central Kalahari? How would I do that? I realized that it takes about 20 years to become a really good tracker and have this nature connection. So I'd grown up in the intertidal and in diving in the Great African Sea Forest. So at least I knew quite a lot about that environment. So if I could somehow learn tracking in a place I'd grown up and I'd had at least 10 years of very powerful immersion, if I did another 10 years every day, maybe I could attain some level of connection. So I set a goal of diving every day for 10 years. And I set a goal of trying to track underwater because I knew that tracking was the key. This is a way of pattern recognition where you can see tiny signs and you can see what's been happening at night. You can even see future events by a whole lot of sign and clue. And it took me literally, you know, I think it took 3 years to see my first track underwater. That's how difficult it was. But as soon as I saw the first one, then it started to go much faster. And I realized there were thousands of these tracks underwater. They're not the same on land at all, but I got so excited because I realized it would be possible to track animals underwater.
And what was that first track you identified?
So that was a trail of a Bernapina whelk. And these whelks, you know, move along the rocks underwater, and they leave a very fine slime trail, and then tiny particles of sand collect on that trail. And it's one of the most obvious tracks underwater. You'd think I would have seen it, but, you know, if you're not looking for something, you don't look, see. And then it just built from there. Now I have thousands of these underwater tracks that I've known and developed, and they are this amazing language. I think tracking for me is the oldest language on Earth, a universal language. You know, I was out today for 6 hours practicing that on the shore and in the rock pools and in the water. It's, but you know, you need I realize I need more than 10 years in the water. I need a lifetime. So it's an exciting thing to keep developing.
I'm an amateur tracker myself, both on land and when I dive and free dive it. And I know what you mean. And one of the exciting things about this book was I felt that you gave my interest in my curiosity of voice. Like, you described the feelings that I have when I'm under water, if I'm trying to find a nurse shark, you get this sense. And so I just appreciate, I felt so connected with your experience and again, giving voice to my feelings. It's been amazing. And while we are on tracking, I know at the end of your book, you give some tips, but give us a few tips before we move on and kind of delve into the kelp forest about how people could use that skill.
What I would recommend is try to go to a place that's really close to your house and that you can get to every day, even if it's for just half an hour. And sometimes it's really good to, you know, sit in the same place and just watch and see what animals are coming. And then when an animal passes by, then go afterwards and look at that track and try and remember what that animal did. And then connect up the dots. That's a very powerful way of learning. And photograph the tracks, get to know them, and build a little library of your own of these animal tracks, say if they are on land. And you sort of build this library up, and you must remember you've got a million years of doing this in your evolutionary memory. So you know how to do it. You just need to start. Buy a book on the tracks of your area so you can help identify them. And you just start building this incredible library in notes, in your books, in your photographs, and you can build it up. And when you've got some understanding of it, then maybe go out with someone who's a amphibian expert or a bird expert or a mammal expert, and you need learn about their behavior of these animals, and you start to connect all the dots. Underwater, it's a different story. You have to choose places that there's not a very, very strong swell. So I choose little places where there are rocky promontories, where there's thick kelp forest, low tide often, and where the water is not swirling and moving too much. And then you start there, and you can see a lot of tracks on the sand. And again, follow animals, start connecting the dots, and then eventually you will even be able to track in the rough water.
So two of the most amazing places I've been privileged to spend time are coral reefs and kelp forests. And unfortunately, kelp is the new coral now, in that these are two ecosystems that are both in trouble. We've lost almost a third of the world's kelp forest that is covering a third of the world's coastlines. It's different in South Africa. Your sea forest is actually expanding. The southeast winds have brought up more nutrients, and you're going around the corner. And could you talk a little about that? And if that's climate related, what's going on to grow your forest?
What's happening here is, due to climate change, the southeaster, which is our dominant wind, especially in summer, is blowing stronger and more often. So what is it? What it's doing is blowing that top water offshore and creating more stronger upwelling, bringing more nutrients into the shallows. And that's what, as you know, that's what the kelp forest feeds on, all these nutrients. The kelp forest is actually growing slightly in size because of that.
Does that mean it's healthy?
The habitat is pretty healthy here. We have, you know, invertebrate life is doing extremely well. Unfortunately, the fish life, the lobster life, the abalone have been heavily overfished and poached. So all the animals that people need for extraction for food, the lobster are down to 2% of their original population, abalone maybe 10%. Many of the fish species are highly endangered. So we need to stop many of the pressures, including pollution, to let those animals regenerate, because you need those animals, you need the predators. There's been some very unfortunate shark fishing as well. We so badly need the predators to, you know, for a healthy system.
That was the cheerful sound to our friends the dolphins. And what's a dolphin's favorite TV show? No, not Flipper, Whale of Fortune. How do you know when a cetacean race is over? They've reached the dolphinish line. Finally, what do groups of dolphins listen to? Podcasts, of course. Speaking of which, Rising Tide, the Ocean Podcast, is a project of Blue Frontier. You can learn more about our work to protect our ocean coasts and communities at our newly updated website, www.bluefront.org. Just two of our projects worth mentioning are the Point Mulati Alliance in Richmond, California, which has now successfully led a 20-year community battle to protect a 413-acre wild headland on San Francisco Bay. Point Mulati was going to be sold off for a casino or a gated luxury development, but thanks to PMA's efforts, by the end of this year, we should see a world-class public park established in this low-income underpark community, an environmental justice victory long overdue. We also just sailed Blue Frontier's new flagship, the Queen of the Coast, into San Francisco Bay. This 1934 William Hand-designed motor sailor will soon see service as an educational platform and youth maritime training vessel, as well as a way to link the wooden boat, maritime history, and marine conservation communities together in our shared belief in historically healthy seas. So, a few more cheers from our dolphin friends, and back to our interview with Craig.
Can you talk a little bit more about that predator-prey relationship and the importance of that in this ecosystem and actually all ecosystems?
Sure. I mean, only 2 days ago, I was doing my trekking along at the tip of Africa, and there was a big 3-meter bronze whaler shark with all the telltale signs of the orca kill. You see the big bite marks on the fins. The stomach is split right open. The livers have been taken out.
We're sitting here with the jaws open. I'm sorry, Rob.
So they even do this to the big great white sharks. I mean, these animals specialize in hunting sharks. I mean, it is quite concerning because we desperately need those big sharks to keep the ecosystem in place. I mean, they are keeping the fish populations, the seal populations healthy by predating the weak, the sick, the injured. And I wonder, you know, would these orcas be predating as many sharks in a fully healthy environment? And the number of the sharks they kill is quite frightening. So I think the system is off balance. And it's probably because we've taken out a lot of those big predator fish that would be food for a lot of these animals. It's a tricky, tricky situation.
Things are definitely out of balance. And part of it is, well, part of it is greed. Part of it is ignorance. We've just recently recognized that the transient orcas and the resident orcas are two distinct species of life. One thing we do know is when you protect nature, it's tremendously resilient. Things come back. There's a lot of talk of marine protected areas of getting to 30 by 30, protecting 30% of land and water by 2030. Or is there movement for creating large areas, protected areas for the African sea forest?
There has been a lot of work done in South Africa in marine protected areas, but you have to remember it's a much trickier situation here in many ways because we are coming with a legacy of apartheid. And during apartheid, the marine protected areas were seen as a place of privilege for white people to enjoy. In many ways, you know, the larger black and brown populations see those areas and it holds tremendous sadness and pain for them. So we have to be so careful in how we do these marine protected areas in South Africa. They have to be so inclusive and ideally driven by local people. There's one fantastic area just up the coast, the Titsikama area, where it's a full marine protected area, but some of the local people are allowed to harvest within the marine protected area. And they have been very careful with their harvest, doing it in a wonderful way, gentle way. And then when outsiders come in who just want to take as much as they can get very quickly, they are actually then those local people are protecting the environment. So that has worked extremely well. So we have to use ways of protecting here in South Africa that's very caring of the local, and especially the indigenous people who've had such a difficult time during apartheid. It's a tricky scenario. We have many protected areas, but I feel we need far bigger spaces. As you know, lots of small protected areas are good, but they're not nearly as effective as very large areas, because you need large areas for animals to truly regenerate.
And this is always the issue with people. I mean, the most effective marine protected areas are initiated by local fishermen and fisherfolk in places like Puerto Rico or, again, the Philippines, but they tend to be smaller. The really big ones tend to be set up by nation states and agreements that don't incorporate the local people. So how do you get big and get the people engaged? And that's certainly a challenge.
Yeah, I mean, I think we have to look to indigenous knowledge and to high-level science, people who truly care about nature, and put those two wisdoms together to find the best ways of protecting these critical places. I mean, our areas here are biodiversity hotspots, so if they're protected, they can regenerate enormous areas of the ocean, and that's one of the things we desperately need to do.
And what are some of the other things your Sea Change project works on?
So we are working on an exciting project to study 1,001 species in the kelp forest and to bring these animals' extraordinary stories to light. Because, and one of my biggest concerns is we're losing touch with these relationships with the wild. For thousands and thousands of years as humans, we've had these incredible connections, these stories of nature, the incredible empathy with animals developed through tracking. We care deeply about our wilderness, and you can see that even today, 80% of the biodiversity on land is protected by indigenous people. So we are trying through storytelling to connect people back to nature so that they care, and then when you care, you'd obviously be interested in protection. We're doing lots of other things. We're working with IPOS, the International Panel on Ocean Sustainability, helping them with media and strategy for high-level policy and government level. We're working with politicians in South Africa as well to try and change policy towards protecting the ocean, protecting biodiversity. We're making films that show how especially local people are deeply connected to the environment and how important that is. So it's many, many, many projects.
As a nonprofit, maybe go up into like the larger mission of the organization.
The main mission is, well, certainly that's in the front of my mind, mm-hmm. is that, and it's kind of come as a teaching directly from the wild. I've been face to face with these incredible animals in the kelp forest for, you know, 12 years every day. This book tour was the first time I actually went away from that space for a month. Being close with those animals, I've realized that the most precious thing that we will ever, ever encounter in our lives is what I call the mother of mothers. And that is the biodiversity, all the animals and plants, bacteria, and life forms that live on this planet, the millions of them and all their interrelationships. That's the life support system of this planet. That's why all of us are breathing. That's why all of us are eating. And we somehow have to change the story from this madness of infinite capitalism towards looking after our mother of mothers. She's looked after us from the beginning. Now, how do we allow biodiversity to regenerate? Because that is critical if we want to survive as a species. So that is the absolute essence. You know, climate change also absolutely critical, and we've got to look at that, but that's a symptom. At the base level, this is the life force that all of us are drawing on and have drawn on from the beginning. And that is this precious thing that we so desperately need to feel, not just intellectually understand, feel her, this massive biological intelligence, and look after her.
So I think with your 1,001 species project, you certainly created global empathy and love with one of those species, with my octopus teacher. If you can do 1,000 more of those, maybe humanity might shift some.
That's the general idea. Thank you.
I think your Academy Award winning film, My Octopus Teacher, was a great introduction to connect people with one of the odd, intelligent alien life forms. And I think that your new book, Amphibious Soul, connects us with another odd, intelligent life form, which is yourself and your relationship to the world. So thank you for both.
Yeah. And I wanted to ask you, I was really moved by your account of seeing Rene Russ' ancient art portraying the underwater scene of the half human, half fish. You call it the water maiden, you know, and you talk about this marriage of the human mind and the intelligence of water.
Yeah, I went to visit Rene, who's this amazing archaeologist and scholar who studied these incredible rock paintings for so long. And she goes on these rickety ladders and spends ages copying these incredible artworks. And she laid out this transparency on her huge table on her farm, in her farm. And I was just absolutely gobsmacked, you know, to see these extraordinary creatures, this beautiful art of these half human, half fish forms. And Rene even has these amazing verbatim texts from these indigenous people who have interacted with these creatures created by the mind. Obviously, a lot of this is mysterious and it's hard for the Western mind to understand. But the wild mind, this wild part of us, understands these things, understands the sacred. We all lose hope, but only if we look at it through the tame mind, you know, just through the logical mind. When we go into the wild mind, into the deep part of our psyche that knows how to track, that knows the wild, that knows reciprocity with the wild, we know that there is a great deal of hope. We know that we can actually deal with these things and we can build this relationship back with our extraordinary ocean and this extraordinary planet.
I just want to thank you so much, Craig Foster, author of The Amphibious Souls, a great book, and filmmaker, My Octopus Teacher. It's been a delight. I feel so connected to the wildness that you talk about and our deep and beautiful ocean, our mother. Let's all take good care of her. Thank you so much.
And fabulous talking to both of you. Thank you so much. Bless you.
Rising Tide, the Ocean Podcast, is a production of Blue Frontier, co-hosted by Blue Frontier's David Helbard and Vicki Nichols Goldstein of the Inland Ocean Coalition, with production support from Holden Hardcastle of Fluid Studios, Natasha Benjamin and Nick Paz, and editing services provided by Charles Landon of Studio Kate May. You can find Rising Tide at bluefront.org or on Apple, Spotify, or wherever you download your podcast. And don't forget to recommend the Rising Tide Ocean Podcast to your friends and other ocean lovers.
Off in the salty ocean, off where the waves roll free, the sparkling water rises, then crashes to the sea. Out amongst the breakers, you'll have no need to fear. It's true, it's the Blue Frontier. Off in the salty ocean, off to the Blue Frontier.
Sparky, come here, buddy. Sparky. There you are. Good boy, Sparky.